Hey, hi, hey, you sweet, sweet person. Welcome to Praise Dionysus. Praise him. It is just Jake today. That is me. We are Jamesless, but we will soldier on and we'll see how it goes. So, you and I are going to be talking about four shows today. And this is what they are. So we've got Signal by Darcy Short, A Tomb with a View by the Essendon Theatre Company, Pane di Casa, A Taste of Home by Carlotta Migliolo Jones, and Much Ado About Nothing by the Australian Shakespeare Company. So strap yourself in. It's a four-show ride. I think going to be quite assuredly going to be, a goofy little time. So, yeah, let's get started. Hey, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for waiting out the intro with me. I love that you and I have these secret little, like, I don't know how long you've been listening to this show for, but I love that you and I have potentially just developed this, like, secret little underground collection of all these episodes where it's just you and me spending time together with, I don't know, with you know, in James's absence. Which I should explain, I suppose. I always forget to do that. And it always, I don't know, I fear it seems like passive aggression, but it's not that. It seems like sort of like a two-step process. He buckled under the weight of the recent heat wave, because he's an 85-year-old man, and then he went, socializing, nightclubly the other night, and I guess it ruptured a few of his organs? I don't know. So he's just, he's been taken down. Much like Beth March from Little Women, which I did rewatch, and of course I mean the Greta Gerwig one. But yes, fear not, Jake haters. James will be back super duper soon. Especially because we're about to start, the next episode is going to be the beginning of Jake and Jamesy's second Chuckle Fest, where we take on the Melbourne Comedy Festival, which should be good. That's in the future. And where are we? We're right now. I think this episode's going to be, fun. I'm excited to talk about literally all of these shows. They're very, different from each other and all quite peculiar. So I think we should have a good time. Trust me if you want, but that's my hot take on the impending festivities. I'll quickly tell you a little bit about the most recent chunk of my life that I've been forced to bravely live through. I went to see, not to keep talking about movies, there are other things going on. I just started this new job. It's very good. It's of course, tricky to navigate your way through an existing social situation. I know that sounds like I don't have any friends at this job, but I'm beginning to, and it's nice. I like the people. And I like the style of service. It's a bar. It's nice to not feel like a sniveling table servant, which isn't to say that that's how every member of a traditionally structured and functioning restaurant should feel. It sounds like I'm really trying to dodge cancel culture from the hospitality industry. I think that's how I approached it. I've talked a little bit on this podcast about how I felt like part of why I was good at serving tables is because I'm just especially prone in some ways to just embracing the feeling of being somebody's servant. The broken parts of my psyche make me built for sniveling, but I don't. I think it's good that this new job does not foster those cerebral muscles to be flexed as often or at all. I didn't even intend to talk about that, but take from that what you want. To continue writing in my audio diary, what else has happened? I went to see Vanya. It's this adaptation that Andrew Scott and Simon Stevens, you probably know what this is. Andrew Scott and Simon Stevens adapted together for the National Theatre, this adaptation of Uncle Vanya, the Chekhov play. And it's, sorry to bore you if you know what this is, but it's a thing that, happened, of course, at the National Theatre in England, and they filmed it and had put it in cinemas. And it's been quite a successful, considering what it is, it's been a very successful version of this. It's not doing well compared to some sort of mega blockbuster like Madame Web, but it's, getting an impressive amount of ticket sales and attention from, theatre cinema goers. Went to see that by myself, and it was bliss. It was so nice. It's Andrew Scott playing all of the characters in Uncle Vanya, and so it's a one-man show, but he plays a full cast of characters, but not in a way that is just meant to wow you because of all the different hats and accents he knows. It's so many fully realized beautiful depictions of all these different people, and it was so tremendously moving because of and I don't know, irrespective of the fact that it was just, you know, Mr. Scott up there doing these things, it was just so... At the same time as, and for that reason, like, at the same time as it being, like, a wonderfully moving, engaging, complicated, layered piece of theatre, with it also being so simple, but so magnificently complicated, and such a showcase and masterclass in Andrew Scott's capacity as an actor, it was, at the same time, like, a marvellous celebration of theatre's capacity. That's something that I got out of it. While thinking about what to want to talk to you about, that's, I think, the last thing I want to say about that. I just think if you get a chance to see it, I think it's worth doing. And message me when you do so, when we can talk about it, because, it's one of those things where it's like, I love this thing, and it seems like there's no one in my immediate vicinity that has also seen it, so I'm just sort of, like, octopusing into the great vacuum of the universe, with no one to discuss Andrew Scott's marvellousness with. No one will heed this advice, but if you have a chance, he and Simon Stevens, I love their artistic working and, like, friendly relationship so much, and if you feel like sort of wasting an afternoon that turns into an evening, I would say just go on the internet and just find any footage of the two of them talking about when they worked together on Seawall. I just think it's just a fun place to spend some time. If you like, you know, listening to smart people talk about things that they're good at. That's that. But also, yeah, this other little tiny sort of, like, I don't know, what's the word for when there's, like, a little head springing off a body? The word is vestigial. Vestigial. This is the vestigial head on the body of my Vanya story. I went to see a different movie. Again, I have other stuff going on. So I went to see another movie. I went to see, I guess I can tell you what it was. It wasn't hardcore pornography. It was at the Cinema Nova, and I went to see The Zone of Interest, which I thought, I really loved the setting, that being a backyard next to Auschwitz. And not in the way that I would want to have, like, a lunch there, but I just thought it's a cool place for a story to be set. Enjoyed the setting. Very, of course, loaded and interesting. What a watered-down way to describe the setting of the backyard next to Auschwitz. And in execution, the film seems to have been made in a very, like, unique and fascinating and intense way. I just was a little bit hungrier for some, like, twists, turns, and narrative. But that's my, you know, unrequested take on The Zone of Interest. But before the film started, everyone's sitting there in this cinema together, because that's how the movies work nowadays, and it was just, like, normal ambient cinema noise, and, like, the trailers kind of come to an end, and the movie is clearly about to start, and there's, like, you know, just, like, the expected rustling of people reaching into packaging and taking food out and chomping upon it, and... It's just like the sound of people at the movies. And then this very confident sort of older woman turns in her seat to face everyone in the cinema. She's talking to a collection of, I'd say, at least, like, around 30 people, and very, with excellent diction and no qualms about addressing a group of strangers, insists that we all be silent as we all watch this important film, but not in a way that is meant to, I don't know, elevate our appreciation and gravitas in terms of World War II, but because she doesn't want to have to be, I guess, reminded that there are other people around her watching it. And I, of course, resent this woman. I think that's an atrocious thing to do. And as one of the very quick-to-fight people's responses was like, this isn't a private screening. Go home if that's how you want to watch a movie. And it's like, wow, people are really ready to just fight at the movies. And it was good in the way that it made me feel safe and protected and didn't make me feel like I would have to be, like, I don't know, I wouldn't end up being the first one to step into fisticuffs with this older lady. But I just, I wonder what it's like living like one of those people that is just like, someone says something defamatory, you are just like, defamatory? Inflammatory? I guess no one's being defamed. Inflammatory like that. That you were just like, with no hesitation, just ready to jump on this lady. No one was hurt, and it was a strange thing to encounter at the cinema. Anyway, I'm going to stop rambling. I think of this, like, last little chunk of time, I'm going to give it, I think, 11 stars, because I think that's how many people were in the Vanya screening with me, and they were the right level of silent. Honestly, I think I was the one giggling most, and that isn't me saying that I won the experience, but that's preferable to, I don't know, than being, I don't know, surrounded by chuckles, especially disappointing ones. I God, there's a few things, like the style of disheartening that is being disappointed by the senses of humour of the people around you. Anyway, yeah, that's a judgmental dark tone, quack quack, to end this intro on. But yeah, I think it's time that we start talking about some theatre. Hey, so I went to the Butterfly Club. This is the second last play that we'll be talking about. That was part of the one-act play festival that they just wrapped up doing. The play is called Signal. It's by Darcy Short. Full disclosure to start off with, Abby Hansen is a pal of mine. I think they're so wonderfully talented, and there's just an oddness that I hope you get to experience at some point, seeing them on stage or off, honestly. They're a very engaging, intelligent person, and also playwright. So that's just a thing to put a pin in that, and I'm sure we'll come back to more of Abby's career in the soon future. Also, as well, Sophie McRae, who is a person that I like know very, very slightly in a social sense, but largely I've spent much more time with her being on stage and me sitting in the darkness. You may remember Sophie from her wonderful performance in that play that I would believe was called A Few Things That Happened on the Way to Now. It was on a little room on a roof on a tall building in the city. Does that jog your memory? It was... to summarize what that was, it was a one-woman show, and it kind of like sits sort of in terms of like content and tone, it kind of like, if you want to be real broad and lazy with comprehending kind of what that show was, it was like a nice little conjunction point between The Carrie Diaries and Sex and the City, if we just followed like a much more likable version of Sarah Jessica Parker / Anna Sophia Robb's depiction of Carrie Bradshaw in kind of like the interim years between, I don't know, but between her like meeting Samantha as a teenager and then being kind of like a dizzy doofus in her late 30s. I'd say that's kind of like where that show kind of sat. And that was my first experience with Sophie being truly marvelous. And this show too, Signal, really was just like a really like welcome reminder of just like, I love listening to her voice. I love the way that there's just like, she's so anchored into the present moment of the drama that she's inside of. This is me talking about Sophie McRae, of course, and not Anna Sophia Robb, just to keep you up to date with what I'm talking about. But yeah, there's four people in the show, and two of them are people that I've, you know, very likely touched the shoulders of. Anyway, so the show itself, it's four people sitting around. They sort of trickle into this recognizable sharehousey environment. And they are sitting around. In terms of like the synopsis of the play, it says that they're listening to like... They're either listening to the Triple J Hottest 100, you know, that countdown thing they do that cool people do. And I say cool in the way that I'm unimpressed by. Because, you know, I'm just, you know, above that type of thing. No, I think, not that anyone should ask, but I think I'm just jaded about the Hottest 100. Not just because of, like, the very valid Australia Day controversy, Invasion Day controversy, I guess I should say, surrounding the movement of that day around. But on top of that too, the only memorable experience I have with actually like engaging with, and by that I mean listening to actively, the Hottest 100 countdown, is just like, you know, like a dramatic high school afternoon that we spent at a pool. And yeah, I don't want to get into more details about it. Because we were 17. And who even remembers being that age? Anyway, these four people are sort of sitting around listening to the radio, and then it comes to pass that after we've sort of gotten to know these four people, the other two, other than the two aforementioned performers, is also Grace Boyle and Gemma Carfi. And they're sitting around, and then through just listening to the radio, some knobs get turned, and then we come to hear that the conversations that they are having are being broadcast on the radio. And the rest of the play takes place in a way of like watching them deal with the fact of them now being broadcast across to anyone who's listening to it. Like if you happen to tune into the specific radio station that their voices are on, they can now be heard by anyone listening to that frequency. And then the play decidedly, of course, takes turns in regards to the way that the characters handle that, which is a sentence that is true of most dramatic works. I really enjoyed spending time with these four people. There was, even in the, like, I believe the show was about 45 minutes long, which was a cool length for the story that they were telling, or at least the version of the story they were telling. There's certainly room for this story to get, and this play, I guess, this play to get developed and reshaped and built up in particular ways, because especially towards the end when everything kind of begins to, not disintegrate, but kind of like, the bulk of the play, I'd say like two-thirds of the play... feels very connected and similarly styled. And then, yeah, towards the end of it, there's almost these, like, flashes of strangeness that feel like the real beginnings of... I don't know if that's the direction that the play is going to go in. I'm excited to see, like, regardless, honestly, that there's so much fertility in this story and in this the style of the writing and in Darcy's voice. But, it got kind of a little, I don't know, odd and a little kaleidoscopy in the way that the play kind of wrapped up and the images that we were seeing. Like, there was a point at which Sophie McRae's character was crawling across a couch carrying a satellite. Like, what are they called? Those little, like, satellite antenna things where it looks, I don't know. Listen to me being an electrician. It's like those things that you have on the roof of a house that look kind of like an angry metal paper aeroplane. I don't know. So she was walking around with... It's probably called an antenna, and I'm just complicating it because of simplicity. But beyond that, there were also, like, a few, like, neat little seeds planted that I enjoyed. One of them being, like, just a set touch that I really liked, that the moment I saw it, I just thought it was, like, whoever chose to include it, I was just into it. There was, like, you know, when you buy those, like, little decorative disco balls, and there's, like, six of them in, like, a little plastic package, and you, I don't know, you crack that baby open and string them up around the house when you want to feel especially festive or something, and they were, like, just sitting in their packaging on the bookshelf, and I just thought that was, like, a neat touch on in ways that were not just adding to this idea of, like, wanting it to be, like, again, a very recognizable share house environment we were spending this story inside of. But I just think there's something very, like, loaded and symbolic and nice about owning those things that are kind of, like, meant to preempt and expect and be prepared for moments of glee. I just think the way that symbolically took me on a brief little journey of hope, and to think of house parties to come, I just thought was nice, especially when we're watching this play that in many ways is about the connection of these four people. It was just a thing that I apparently enjoyed, because here I am still talking about it. There were also, like, a couple of seeds planted that I think if this play is to be developed or, I don't know, further, I'd say that these are things that I'd be really excited to see explored. One of them being wokeness as a weapon. It was a thing that I think was one of the most, like, present themes, present in the work, the idea of, having, like, a heated conversation about this yesterday with one of my new work friends, about the people sort of, like, putting on the armor of their, I hate saying wokeness, because it feels like such, like, an old word and a judgmental one, and one that's also rooted in, you know, social phenomena that it's just a lot to bring up. But the idea of people wanting to, like, social justicely win a conversation, or preferring to be kind of like mediators between conversation and this unseen, omnipresent judge, and wanting to referee people's correctness, and that being a weapon that people bring to, you know, conversational knife fights that is much larger than the knives that the people are wielding. I don't know. You understand what I'm saying, I'm certain. The wet blanket, I suppose, just to keep throwing metaphors at you of people that aren't able to have, like, nuanced, delicate human conversations out of a fear of, I don't know, being fly-swatted by the god of political correctness. that was something that was very present in the work. And as well, I thought, and this feels like a thing that has been bubbling and being present in a few of, like, the contemporary stories we're hearing, especially about people in, like, I feel like it was almost like a little present, and maybe I'm implanting this just because I enjoyed the work so much, but remember that show that I watched in the backyard of that house that all those, like, young people during Midsummer made called Marriage? I feel like it was a little bit present in that, but it seems like, especially in, people in, like, their 20s and early 30s, it seems like a lot of the works that they're putting forth, especially, like, the rather, like, naturalistic kind of contemporary issue plays that we're seeing, there seems to be this, like, this beginnings of unpacking and kind of critiquing this very real phenomenon of, like, I don't know, upper middle class, like, children of wealthy people being drawn to artistry. And it seems like we're burgeoning on this place of almost having that conversation, and whether or not that was, like, hastened by this nepotism conversation that's been had for, like, some time now, very much, like, presently in the zeitgeist. Another word I get really impatient with saying with my mouth. It seems like, yeah, this play really planted the seeds of beginning to talk about that. And yeah, I just wanted to bring that up because it seems like one of these trends that's happening. And I don't know, I'm excited. I'd be so keen to see a play that really took on this thing of like, okay, your parents have five houses. Why do you want to make art? And I don't say that because I don't think that those people should be allowed to, or that they would have nothing interesting or impressive to say. But I think it's a provocative sentence. And I think a play or something that explored that idea would just be like a fun night at the theater. I think it would make people... I don't know. I think it would push people into some like uncomfortable positions. And I think it would just be like some fun new theater discourse to have, especially in the independent sector for a number of reasons. And so if you're out there, you know, hungry for an idea, take that one. Cause I'm super keen to come to that show. Yeah. And this show, Signal by Darcy Short. Yeah. Kind of had the beginnings of that idea and like little saplings of those types of thoughts happening, which I, of course, yeah, obviously found to be quite stimulating. Yeah, the play goes on and they sort of like decide quite quickly that once they realize that they're on the air, that they can potentially use this opportunity of being broadcast to people as an opportunity to raise money for one of the characters' mother's dementia treatment and making her comfortable in her predicament. And that's I guess, I think I've hedge-trimmed this description into kind of all of the beats that kind of get hit by this work. Yeah. But yeah, a charming cast, a really fun voice that I haven't experienced before in terms of the playwright. And again, I think that the show's strengths lie in not just, of course, the ensemble, but yeah, also in the oddness. And then, yeah, the beginnings of these like really fun ideas that were certainly present. And I think if it's going to have a second life, which I hope it does, there's more to explore, especially too, like in the impressive like sound work that was done. Yeah, and the oddness, I think, I don't know, I'm a bit of a broken record in terms of just like, you know, being excited by oddness, but especially too, like watching the scaffolding of this work kind of implode a bit towards the end, stylistically and very deliberately. It's like, if that's one of the things that is going to be inflated and emphasized in future productions, I'd be really interested to see what this like group of, you know, smart theatre makers would do with that. So, but yeah, to talk of, I don't know, to abruptly summarize, I guess, what Signal is in its like current state, the state that I experienced, I don't know, I guess I wrote down as I was leaving the theatre, it felt to best think of it as a quasi-liquid depiction of the foibles of a public existence, which is just a sentence I thought I'd burden you with. Hey, it is still me. So I very recently went to the Essendon Theatre Company, which if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you're well aware that I'm deeply in love with, to refresh your mind or to let you know for the first time about my, I don't know, thorough passion for this venue and collective. The theatre itself is like a broad, beautiful, like community theatre performance space, a little risen stage, very wide, very lovely, and then pointed at it are a collection of dining room tables that you sit around and watch. Angelo Snell recently described it to me as cabaret seating, which it absolutely technically is. I've never connected those dots before because not just of simplicity, but I guess I've also been mistaught by media that cabaret seating has to just be those tiny little teetery elegant tables that can only fit like two glasses of wine and a candle in the middle of it. But no, this is absolutely cabaret seating. Just because you can fit a whole family around it and a bunch of camembert on top of it doesn't make it not cabaret seating. Does it render all of my detailed descriptions of this theatre space in the past embarrassingly redundant? Perhaps, but here we are. No regrets, let's move forwards. So the show itself is called A Tomb with a View. I'm on record as saying that I loathe puns, and I continue to do so. But I soldiered through that because, again, I love this company, and this show looked like fun. Which it, yeah, ended up being. It's a comedy thriller by Norman Robbins, and it's directed by Les Hart. And I had the good fortune of running into Les, the director, after the show, and he, like, I don't know, let me know this, like, sweet little tidbit that he doesn't even know where he came across this script from. It just happened to be, like, in the collection of plays that he has at his home, and his current theory is that it was just, like, a thing that he got for free when he purchased a bunch of other plays, which I just think is a super charming backstory for this literary discovery. The play itself is a whodunit. It's set very, like, lovelily and almost, like, tropally in a big old mansion, and there's a kooky rich family that lives there, and they haven't been outside, and their surname is Tomb, and they do say the title of the show in the show. I won't tell you who says it, and I won't tell you how they managed to fashion it into a sentence that renders it not sounding like clunky nonsense, because it's a hard title to work into a sentence. I challenge you to do it. Send them to me in audio files. But yeah, they managed to do it. Yeah, it's the Tomb family, and they are gathered around because the patriarch has died, and the money has to go somewhere. And yeah, they're all sort of gathered for the will reading. The set itself continue as always. They know how to do a set at this place. So beautiful. Just a big empty bookshelves at the back in this big wide performance space, a door leading to like a semi-visible garden out to the left, and on the right it leads further into this spooky mansion. In the center, above the fireplace, there's this portrait of the deceased patriarch who looks delightfully a lot like Mr. Burns doing the little like evil finger pyramid of scheming, which I truly believe is one of the greatest gifts that The Simpsons ever gave to us. Which, just to briefly accidentally tangent, I guess is also on the same list as Lurleen Lumpkin and her entire music career. The episode where Bart goes to a burlesque house and they sing We Put the Spring in Springfield. I guess a lot of the musical contributions that they've made to television are what I'm largely grateful for. And also, of course, the melancholy of Marge. But let's stop being distracted. Come on. Pull your socks up. Let's get back to A Tomb with a View. So I'm, of course, because it's a whodunit, I'm not going to, like, spoil any of the plot or whatnot, because if you get to encounter this story again, I don't want to have ruined it for you. But in terms of, like, setup and characters, the patriarch himself, the principal Tomb, died apparently because a bunch of bookshelves fell on him, and he got, unless I misheard this, after I heard it, I was like, did I don't know, like mentally yawn or something and mishear half of this explanation in terms of his demise? But what I believe happened was a bunch of bookshelves, like wooden bookshelves, fell on him, crushing him a bit. And then there was a wood disease in the bookshelf that was passed on to him. And that's what killed him. So make of that what you will. Are you suspicious about that being a cause of death? Do you think that's crazy and he's probably secretly living in the walls? These are options. You can have a third idea. But yeah, that's the setup. And the family all lives in the house. For whatever reason, they're all kind of like they've confined themselves to living in this house. While they have a nurse there, they have like a housekeeper there, and I don't know, none of them really seem super fit to live in the real world, so for, I guess, everybody's welfare, they just don't go outside and mingle with, like, even the inconveniently far away village people. Village people that, the people that live in the village, not village people, the band? You gaybo. Sorry for calling you a gaybo. Let's dive into some characters and give you an idea of, like, the people populating this goofy world. Michelle Tanner plays Dora, one of the, like, adult siblings. It's largely just, like, made up of adult siblings, honestly. The children of Mr. Burns. Michelle Tanner plays Dora, so she's this loopy lady that keeps debatably accidentally poisoning people that visit the house and then burying them in her garden. And this is one of the first characters that we kind of get, like, a rounded out understanding of her, like, demeanor and behavior in this home. And it's like, oh, this is where we're starting. A beautiful goofy lady that murders people to pass the time, and that's the beginning point we have for you in terms of this spectrum of character that we're developing. Sarah Jane Smith plays Emily, a deeply unlikable person who spends a lot of the play just munching on apples and talking down to people, a very welcome presence. There's a lot of whimsy in the show, and I think it really helps when you have someone like this to just kind of like trudge around and make people feel a bit garbage. It's just, I don't know, somehow feels very grounding. Maybe that says more about me as an audience member and person, but yeah, Sarah Jane's presence was very, like, you couldn't forget that Sarah Jane was there. I think largely because the social danger she posed to everybody was so present. I'm not gonna list everybody, of course, but it's, I don't know, it doesn't go without saying. I'm gonna say it because it doesn't go without saying. This ensemble was so wonderful. It requires such, like, detail and mechanics, and this play especially, like, very farcical, a lot of entrances and exits, and a lot of exposition, and a lot of, like, frantic interrogations, and it's just, to achieve, it's like a long play too. It was like a 3 hours-ish, and with an interval in the middle, but, oh my god, but it flowed so smoothly, and again, so charmingly, from even the fact of, like, at interval, you could, like, put a pen mark next to the actor that you, like, the character that you thought the murderer was, and then at the start, even just the very start of the show, on top of already being at these, like, deeply beloved, untraditionally large cabaret tables, for the moment that, like, the lights went down and the songs, like, the music started, and it was like, that was actually not a recording, that was literally just me making those sounds, I don't know if you could tell, it was just, like, charming from wall to wall, while also being just fantastically earnest. Amber Luca as Monica was astonishing, partly because, of course, of that classic thing of just, like, gay men are designed to adore, like, a cruel, vain, beautiful woman. That's just a rule that exists. on top of that, too, Dion Krimpotic, which is definitely how to pronounce that, played Marcus. This absurd creature of a person who's this just, like, handsome man who is convinced that he is Julius Caesar. And part of what was just astounding about Dion's performance was just that on paper is a strange man to be. And there was something so steadfast in his delivery of this performance that I think part of what made it so gripping was we never got an explanation as to why he is this way. There was never a, oh, he was bonked on the head while playing Julius Caesar, or he just ate too much pizza one day, or all of his friends stabbed him once. There was none of that. It was just, he's in a toga sometimes, and he quotes Shakespeare at us. Never gets more rounded, really. And that's perfect. And I think that's why his just very endearing commitment to this, and the stoicism and the elegance of his portrayal made his, I'm going to spoil one death. He dies, and I'm only bringing it up to point out the fact that he'd got the largest sort of, like, dismayed response from everybody. And I think that just, I don't know, speaks volumes of Dion's performance and his characterization. And I felt it too. When he went down, I felt bad about it. I'm not built to emotionally withstand, I learned this watching the show, I'm not built to emotionally withstand the emotional impact of a whodunit-y murder parade like this. It's just too much. I think too much about them as children. I think too much about the time they've spent reading books and learning and trying to become better people. And then they just get offed by some unseen figure in this mansion. And it's like, oh no, not Anne. So that's, yeah, a lesson that I learned as well. Also, I reaffirmed the fact that when, and not if, but when I have millions of dollars, that's called manifestation, I want to have, much like the tombs do, a series of passageways inside my house. I just think it's the magicest thing in the world. The fact that even just, like, even my architectural dreams aside, the fact that this set had in it a bookshelf that would fold back and permit you to scurry about with a lantern in, like, you know, the undercarriage of this home. The show was so full of magic. And can you imagine your own home having such a series of passages? Like, set aside the thrilling, I don't know, secrecy that it would permit during, like, the inevitable panic room-style home invasion. Like, you can just rest assured that you can just be back there like a little mouse, safe from the men pillaging your wares. It's as if you have two houses. You have the house with the windows and the good food and the blankets, and then you have your secret shadow house lurking within the one that you live in most of the time. And if you're just having, like, a terrible day, you can just go back there and, like, lean against the cool stone and just vanish for a bit. I don't know, is this enthusiasm just depression? I don't know! And I also need to bring up Gilbert Gouchy, not just because I enjoy saying that name, but because he played Perry, and the way he turns up, you don't think he's gonna be, like, a central figure in this story, and then very thankfully he is, because my word, this man is marvelous, and I think part of it is because I am just partial to, like, a very, like, handsome, fancy, flibbity-gibbet of a man. I just, like, I think it's because, like, Niles Crane from, like, not that I need to tell you, but from Frasier, the long-running sitcom spin-off of Cheers, was just so delightful to me. There's just something about that type of character that I'll always just warm to, and his presence in the work was just like very exciting and throwing and unpredictable. I just love a fancy, nervous man that has sort of like an asexual energy. It's just, I don't know, it feels like home to me. My home with depression passageways to keep my secrets and safety. So I went to the Butterfly Club, and this is the last of the one-act play festival plays that we'll be talking about. The show is called Pane di Casa, A Taste of Home. The first half of that sentence is Italian, and much like the title, the show was quite bilingual. It wasn't like a 50-50 split, thankfully. Like, I did study Italian for 13 years of my education, which I was also grateful for, because it meant that I could, like, I was testing myself a fair bit, and keeping up more than the average doofus. Which was just fun for me and stimulating. And just, I love the romance languages. My ears like hearing them. It's just, I don't know. Anyway, so the show itself is written by and starring Carlotta Migliolo-Jones and showcases the story of her as a recent immigrant to Australia and what her life is at the moment. In this fictional universe, with that universe, of course, being like what seems like I do not know this experience from a lived perspective, but based on like the things that my pals have gone through, and a close friend of mine has recently come here from Italy and is, you know, like setting down roots, which I'm very grateful for. She's so wonderful. So it was interesting too to see how their experiences, like my friends and Carlotta's, seem to have a lot in common. So it was nice to almost get to feel like I was watching my friend Margarita's story kind of get embodied and told in front of me. It was nice to kind of in that way get to empathically connect a little bit to not just Carlotta but my pal as well. Anyway, yeah, so the show takes shape and it kind of charts the story of Carlotta's character trying to find a job, to feel a bit at home, to work out her relationship with her boyfriend and how that's going to function as they move forward with him being a local. Carlotta's character herself has like a very impressive sort of medical background, but seems unable to find a job opportunity that can permit her to, you know, utilize that skill set, and ends up working at Kmart, is like one of the facets of how this tale unfolds. It was also like theatrically surprising, and the Stagecraft Incorporated was unexpected, I suppose. I guess just because like that space in the Butterfly Club, you're accustomed to like one person, a microphone, a pianist, and then maybe like a television with visual aids on it. But the television in this piece was utilized to like show a Zoom call, which was taking place between a collection of people who have experienced an effort to move to Australia, make some essence of a life here, whether or not it's permanent or short-lived, and their experiences with things like visas and education and racism and those types of things, and just like the culture generally, which was an interesting way to break up this story. And it felt, felt verbatim-y, it felt very honest, and it felt very much like, they scooped these minds together and just interspersed them throughout this narrative, which was just like, a surprising way to break it up. Speaking of surprising things, this moment happened, and I enjoy how sideswiped I felt by this. We're watching the show, and about maybe like, I'd say like 60% of the way through, someone's phone goes off in the audience, and it's like, okay, like it's unfortunate, but it happens to people. So this woman, sort of, she's three rows in front of me, answers the phone call, as you know, the worst of them do, and then starts speaking into her phone to this person, and it's like, okay, wow, this woman is bold. Seems like the sort of person to, I don't know, pontificate to a cinema full of people who care about World War II to a normal extent. But then she's talking on the phone, and then as she sort of like does that, you know, vaguely ashamed waddle out, instead of turning towards the exit, she turns towards the stage and continues walking onto it, and it's like, oh my goodness, Pane di Casa, this taste of home is full of surprises. And ends up being Janine McGrath. And she rocks up, goes on stage, and ends up kind of being one of the villains of the piece. very impressively, I enjoyed her presence in the work a lot. Not in a way that I was rooting for her. There was a lot of, like a fair bit of, I don't know, racism about the way that she engaged with things and the way that she treated a person, just because they have an accent and not a grasp of English and the culture to an extent that she feels them worthy of, you know, giving them a decent amount of respect, whether or not it's because of, you know, she senses foreignness or because they have a Kmart uniform on. It's that type of character that we get to know. And unfortunately for most of us, probably recognize. I liked how much of this show happened at a supermarket, just because I feel like that's where I spend a bunch of time and it registers as a significant destination for me. It's a venue in my life for certain. It's where we meet characters like Josephine Boffer, that is the actor's name, and she plays just a very like lovely baker. And in When Talking, I like saw a sort of like a speak to camera piece by Josephine talking about her character. And she appreciated how much her character was kind of like the embodiment of small acts of kindness and the way that they can really affect a person's life. And I think that, I don't know, that's just a really lovely lesson. And also, like, Manisha in Sarah plays this woman that really just guns for a friendship with Carlotta's character just in the aisle of a supermarket, which, again, I just think is nice. There's a lot of romance for me built into supermarkets themselves. I myself have made a significant connection with a person in a supermarket once, and that's a story that I will tell you in Persian. There's that too. This ensemble was very fun and surprising, and when they got up and bowed at the end and also like gestured at the photos of these people from the Zoom call, it was like, wow, what a collection. It was just like, between all of them, like we had such different experiences with what in many ways is what, like, I don't know, structurally is quite a conventional one-act play, but it just... Again, in terms of like dramaturgy and stagecraft and story structure, it just took these corners, and to see them all bow at the end, it's like, oh wow, this really does look like what an odd little scrapbook, like what a nice little collage of these people that came together to tell one person's story while also managing to tell a few others too. I don't know, it was neat in that way. I also want to bring up Matthew Davila as well, who was playing the partner of Carlotta's protagonist character, who was this like very like devastatingly handsome, very charismatic man who also had this like stunningly earnest little monologue about wanting to be enough for his partner and worrying that he wasn't. That was just great too. And stagedness in a similar way to, and not to keep talking about him because I do it too much, but Paolo Bartolome's performance, he also had like a similarly staged monologue about similar subject matter in Hot White Kiss. So it's just, I don't know, plonk a wonderful man on the left of the Butterfly Club upstairs stage, have him look vaguely off-center and just get him ranting because it's bound to move me. back to Matthew Davila's monologue about wanting to support and protect and effectively love his partner. It was just nice to see a person so, like, earnestly grappling with the demands of romance and the physical mechanics of contemporary love. It's just, you know, just themes that get lost in. And it's just nice to see a person... I don't know, grip onto him so tight. And yeah, that's a credit to the writing and to the performance and of course to the direction as well. I felt very, very lucky to get to hear this story, hear these stories, hear the language. It's just so nice to listen to Italian. to whatever extent the stories that were present were true or based on truth or were just like full on, you know, depictions and adaptations of fact, which is grateful to experience them. It makes it easier to empathize with and you know, understand people that are living very, very different oftentimes lives alongside us in this country that we all share together. It's just nice when a piece of theater makes that effort to bring us all a little bit closer in that way that it's, I don't know, for some people, for whatever reason, is like especially difficult to do. But this style of empathy the thing about culture is the way that it can, like, it can unite us if you're part of it, but can really implant this distance if you have a particular relationship with it, with the one that you're in or the one that you've left behind, to whatever extent that you have. It got me thinking about some things that I hadn't thought about in a little bit, this show, and, yeah, the honesty of it and the beating hearts inside of it were things that I won't forget super duper soon, I'd say. So I went to the Royal Botanic Gardens. No, not to look at the plants, you goddamn nerd. I went there to see the Australian Shakespeare Company's production of Much Ado About Nothing. Full disclosure, I went to this production of, like, this specific performance of this production because Elizabeth Brennan was going on as Beatrice because Anna Burgess was off for the evening for whatever reason. I hope she's fine. But yeah, I went because Elizabeth was stepping up into, you know, the lead woman role, if that's how we're ranking these things. And I just... of course, as you, sweet listener, if you've been here for really any length of time, you know of my deep love for that woman. She's co-hosted a number of times, and she's just very, very impressive. So I went. It's outdoors. There's a little chair for me set up, which is very, very sweet. I sit in that chair. I'm in the second row. It's very nice. I'm sitting next to this woman who I'm sure is lovely, but is having, I think, the stinkiest picnic I've ever smelled in my life, which is, I'm not attempting to shame this woman. Absolutely, please have picnics. That's my bold stance. But yes, if you want to feel like you're, I don't know, in my size 13 shoes throughout this performance, sorry to include that fact. That feels like I'm boasting or something. I'm not. I just felt like giving you more detail. But if you want to feel like... if you want to feel more like you're me, also imagine that the things I'm describing are happening while the waft of apricot jam and sour meats are breezing past your schnoz, is my suggestion. Again, I'm pro-picnic, he bravely said into a microphone. So the show is about to happen. I am reading a book. Again, a needless detail, but now don't you feel like you're there? I know through having spoken to Elizabeth throughout the rehearsal process that the show is a musical. That's a fact that you will notice as I continue to talk about this musical version of Much Ado About Nothing. The thing about Much Ado About Nothing is that I do not know the plot in that I've seen it a number of times on stage, on film. I've really run the gamut of different ways that I've ingested this story, and I can promise you that truly every time that I've experienced it, I think the story was different. There's not, I don't know how, I went in not knowing how the play would go, because I hadn't even, until this production, I had not even, like, wrestled with the fact that the plot of the play never, ever sticks inside of my body. Somehow, I go through it, I feel like I understand the thing, and then it is just, like, washed clean from me. I think partly maybe because the title, again, as we've recently talked about, this trend really seems to be cropping up again. It's one of those something's gotta gives. It's like, Much Ado About Nothing, almost inbuilt into the thing. It's like, yes, we make a bunch of noise, but there isn't a whole bunch going on. And if there's not a whole bunch going on, what am I going to grab onto? I like a bunch. I like a Brady Bunch. But, so maybe that's why? But yeah, so every time I experience this story, it feels brand new to me. So factor that in too, factor in my stupidity. So let's start talking about some things. Let's talk about the music. Super grateful for it in the way of, like, to jump straight from me having said that this story never gets retained by my mind once the bows are done. It really helped. This show made me think about Shakespeare. Don't faint from shock. It made me think about Shakespeare. And as Elizabeth and I have sat here talking about, like, the timelessness and the longevity of Shakespeare's work. And it's like, this show made me especially think about not just Shakespeare's works as longevities. And of course, when I say Shakespeare, I secretly mean Emilia Bassano. But don't get me started on that again. But it's a large part of why the work has been able to survive, and this is not a groundbreaking thing to say, is because it's a text that is theatrical, because it's a theatre text. You know, it's not, he didn't write a series of novels, he wrote a bunch of plays. And of course, to say something very simple and obvious, there's so much remarkableness in the words of Shakespeare. But if we evolved to somehow become, or I guess devolved, depending on, I don't know, your perspective on these things, to become creatures that are capable of little more than just, like, eating food and ingesting media, and no longer capable of turning Shakespeare's works into performed works and uncovering the magic that can be inside of his scripts. I think that would see the demise of his work, you know, in the widespread sense that it is, you know, like, of course, there's always going to be those scholars that enjoy sitting down and just, like, reading through his words and imagining productions, but it's performances like this, it's production companies like this, that since Shakespeare or Amelia, of course, we all know I mean Amelia, wrote these things. The reason that the generations keep passing them down and keep inspiring new tellings of these stories to happen is because of what theatre brings to what Shakespeare offers you as a blueprint and as a guide and as a stimulus for what you're going to do with it. And I think why I, in this moment, felt inclined to drag you through those two paragraphs of Year 11 literature essay was because I think, too, that leads to the idea of, like, what makes a Shakespeare production nowadays a worthwhile endeavor, and how could you, if you wanted to build up some rubric for theatrical efficiency and dramaturgical clarity or something, if that's how you decide to privately rank theater now and then, would be how you overcome the linguistic, even just like the language barrier that so many people talk about when they talk about what keeps them out of a Shakespearean world and a production. If they're going to use that language, how do you sort of like reach over that divide and help people feel like, as I oftentimes feel, and people speak of this, and maybe you feel this way too, that it's almost like sometimes when you're watching Shakespeare, what you're having to do is almost, there's like a little translator in your mind that is kind of like constantly typing and trying to ingest things. Like it's almost you need to implant like a new component of your like listening digestive system in order to understand what's going on. And even that additional process can keep you at a distance, or like, yeah, almost like the energy gets sapped by that translation, and it leaves you almost like there's not enough blood left in your body to also fully appreciate the rest of the things that are going on. And I wanted to bring all of that up to say that I thought this production overcame so much of that so wondrously. And part of it was because of the music. I think that it not just gives you like, it's even like a basic thing of like, it gives you kind of a break from just listening to a bunch of Shakespearean text, which can be fatiguing and again can require a lot of manic blood flow to these new organs you've had to, you know, employ. But two, it also lets you into the text in a new way. And also after coming out of this production, I said to Elizabeth, it was like, where can I listen to these songs again? There are truly some of these, oh, but, and she's bought me the CD, nobody panic, I'm going to get to listen to these songs again, and I will find a way to get at least some of them to you, sweet listener. Because my goodness, the song that kind of like opens the show and closes it, certainly one of my favorite songs. The moment that Elizabeth gives me this compact disc, it's going to become everything to me. There's a few songs throughout, and there's also like, there's a sequence where there's a line dance to a song that, again, this is going to be me. Do not think that Anthony Warlow is in the studio with me and has cut in. But it's like, much ado, much ado, much ado about nothing. And it's like, is that not the best thing you've ever heard? It's just the way that the music elevated and clarified and amplified moments of character and text and, you know, emotionality. You know, I just, yeah, it was smart. And yet to come back to it was a way that they solved that question of like, how can we bring this contemporary audience into this Elizabethan thing that's happening in front of them? If the language is going to be shunting them out, like, how can we bring them a little closer? Let's talk about some cast members. So Nicole Naboo, just to sort of like start anywhere, Nicole Naboo played like the villain of the story, in that she had like very distinct opinions about the marriages that were about to take place. Again, I'm bad at Shakespeare, but played, especially with the musical numbers that she was afforded, it's kind of like if you imagine like Shania Twain was kind of like cast to play a pirate witch. Can you picture that? it was that. Yeah, it was just like she was leather clad and very powerful and just like a grumpy woman that you should not be an enemy of. So I don't know. It was just fun to watch her scheme and be so powerful on stage while she was like strutting around in her leather. As well, Don Pedro was played by Johnny Light and was playing like Shania Twain's sexy pirate brother. And I just really enjoyed watching him. If you make anyone a sexy pirate, I'm going to give them more time. It was great. Just watching him, like, lean his little elbow on people and talk to them about the goings-on, talking to them about all of the ado. I thought he was marvelous, too. I like those characters that seem impatient with stupidity, just in the way of, like, in a dramatic work, it feels like they're almost like the referee of making sure that the story keeps moving and we don't get too bogged down in garbage. So he certainly added that energy to things as well. It's just occurred to me that I do not think that I brought up this very essential thing for you to know, that while they were doing the Much Ado About Nothing line dance to that song that me, not Anthony Warlow, just nailed, all of the men in the dance were wearing confusing masks and were wearing cow pants. And cow pants is not a term you should know. They were wearing pants that were made out of what looked like cow skin. If you killed a cow and made it into pants, I think you've understood the concept, and now something in me is wanting to make it more gruesomely vivid for you. But yes, just imagine talented Shakespeare men in masks and cow pants doing a line dance. You're welcome. I wish you'd been there. We could have shared cheese on the grass. But it was a high point of a show with several high points, and many of those high points were musically founded. I just want to let you know that I paused the recording for a second and went and got a book because I got sick of my own ignorance in terms of what the plot of this play was, and as Jackson Ether has said to me, and often says, ignorance is a choice. And so this book that I have, they've got a brief summary of what the plot of Much Ado About Nothing is. In Sicily, I did not know we were in Sicily. In Sicily, Claudio and Hero, and that wasn't a criticism of it not being Sicilian enough. Don't be Sicily, I'm sorry for saying that. Anyway, in Sicily, Claudio and Hero are cruelly tricked and parted while Benedick and Beatrice fight and fall in love before deceptions and disguises are uncovered by a hapless night watchman and harmonious order is restored with marriages and jigging. Other than the Sicily part, yes, I got all of that from it. Look at me retaining things that I'm experiencing. There's like a death that people think occurs, there is a misunderstanding that throws a romance into disarray. And that's what I'd say most of the ado is. The stakes, for the most part, do not really transcend, or I guess go higher than wanting to marry someone that you like. which is when I think Shakespeare's at his best, said an idiot once, I'm sure. Not me being on any sort of Shakespearean high horse, I just read that summary to you and found it helpful. Also, though, in that summary, I'm not super clear on what a night watchman is. Maybe they adapted it so the night watchman became a sexy pirate, which again is an idea I can get behind. I'm not super clear on what a night watchman is. I think my first go-to media representation of what I would consider to be a night watchman would be those guys that didn't see the iceberg soon enough on the Titanic. I guess maybe just to keep it like dweeby and Shakespearean, maybe it's the two guys that saw King Hamlet's ghost at the start of Hamlet. Does that clarify things? Is it fair to use one night watchman from Shakespeare to think I understand another? Is that classist? These are the questions that I think the Australian Shakespeare Company were trying to pose with their work. Let's jump illogically to Alex Cooper. I once spoke to Alex Cooper in a foyer. Is that a story? No, it's more of a setting. I do not know this man, but I think he's remarkable. Partly because the first and only other time that I experienced him in a performance was when he was playing someone who had a name like Ezekiel, I think, in the Australian Shakespeare Company's production of The Crucible. I just thought he was remarkable in that, the subtlety and nuance that he brought to that role, and it wasn't a role that got a lot of stage time. I'd say he didn't get enough stage time. but yes, he was marvellous as Ezekiel, parentheses, do your own research on that, close parentheses. And yeah, it was very, very jazzed to see him unexpectedly turn up amidst all of this ado. He begins the show dressed like a character from Rock of Ages, and just is immediately transfixing. I find him so mesmerizing. He proved that not only does he have like a really impressive singing voice, but he's also capable of unirritatingly doing that thing where like a man in a musical will stare off into the middle distance and cock his head to the side and wistfully dream of things to come. Like, do you need an example? I don't think so. Like when like Aladdin stares off at the palace in the middle of Agrabah, like wanting what he wants. What does he want? Does Aladdin want a palace? Does he just want bread? Is this classism again? Aladdin wants people to realize that there's so much more to him. What a dreadful example. It's like if you imagine Rob Mills nailing the role of Fiero and while he's singing Dancing Through Life, a song that sucks. but during the pauses where the people around him are swooning, the face he makes when he stares into the middle distance and thinks about more dancing through more of his life. Irrespective, Alex's character wants to, as we learned in that very quick synopsis that I read tremendously, he wants to marry Hero, played by Larissa Teal, who was just magnificent. My God, throughout the entire thing, Larissa was just like befuddlingly graceful and had this like tremendous urgency to her yearnings, which was great. And this, if she hadn't already blown my mind, when she falls to the ground, not to spoil Shakespeare for you, but when she fell to the ground during her like disaster of a, like a marriage attempt, it was truly like, if there was any distance caused by anything Shakespearean, it was completely closed in the grief that she expressed when tumbling to the ground in her wedding dress. It was really, really great. That being said, let's forget emotions for a second and jump to aesthetics very briefly. I just want to say that the costuming in this show was absolutely such... It was like one of my favorite things about it. And I, you know, I hate ranking stuff, but it's like, yeah, when I have ranted to people about my enthusiasm for this production, one of the things that I bring up every single time are the costumes, which were done by Casper Elston. There was this moment where Alex Cooper was wearing this moss-colored suit, and I just like, I had to like stifle a gasp. I just, the color was great. It suited him so well. And just as an outfit was just like, anyone could wear that thing and walk down the street and I'd really want to shake their hand. There was a sequence where a bunch of the woman characters were wearing, they're not can-can dresses, they're like the big, maybe they are can-can dresses, but the big frothy ones, they seem a little bit more country western than a can-can dress. But yeah, they just scream fun and they scream stand in a line and do something together. I don't know. But yeah, across the board, everyone was just dressed so well. It's like every outfit was just so fun and for like distinctly different reasons, but still absolutely hung together in this world, from the cow pants through to the moss-colored suit. To get to text for a second, there were some like modern implantations. There were things like Taylor Swift references and like modern song lyrics that were in it, which, you know, people are into. It got laughs. For me, it felt a bit like, I don't know, somehow the analogy that kept coming to me was like running your hand along silk and then all of a sudden there's some other fabric beneath your fingers. Or maybe it's like eating chocolate mousse in the dark and then, in one of your chews you feel a crunch. I don't know, maybe all of these are wrong. But yeah, I guess if someone named Dogberry is comparing something to a summer's day and then also has opinions about Beyoncé's country album, I don't know, it very, I don't know, quickly shallows your sleep a bit and then the dream stops for a moment. But that's just me. It gets laughs. People like it. I mean, if James were here, he would absolutely advocate for Game of Thrones references in Macbeth, and that's just a certainty that we all have. Before I get to my closing remarks that are of course going to be about Elizabeth Brennan, I need to bring up this thing that happened at interval of Much Ado About Nothing at the Royal Botanic Gardens. If you want to really mess with a person at the theatre, you should do what this very sweet woman did to me when interval rolls around. Interval starts, the lights turn into interval-coloured ones, and then people begin shuffling into their interval behaviour. Within the first 15 seconds, you're me now, remember? My shoes, you were in them, and you're about to, you know, get your book out. You're about to be interval Jake. And then this woman from across the aisle turns to me and says, "We thought you were going to be in the show." This messed me up a little, not in a substantial way, but in a way of like, huh? And as I said to her, I was like, why? In a way that probably came across as vaguely offended. I was like, why? And she was like, I don't know, we just did. And it's like, and then I said, sorry, of course, because I owed her an apology. But I don't know. Again, everyone in the show was so thoroughly stylized from Rock of Ages through to can-can dresses to cows to pirates. I promise I was wearing people clothes, like regular featured extra people clothes. So I guess just something about me reads as audience plant for garden Shakespeare. And now that's a fact that I live with. To round this out, to complete this Adooey experience, I just have to bring up my wonderful pal Elizabeth Brennan playing Beatrice. to understand her depiction of this role, and maybe as the role exists somewhat on paper too, it's like, I'm sure we've all seen Hysteria, that Hugh Dancy movie about the invention of vibrators. Elizabeth's performance reminded me a lot of Maggie Gyllenhaal's performance in that movie. To the person that means anything to, welcome to the same page as me. But Beatrice doesn't care about being married. She is not on a husband hunt, despite what everyone tells her she should be doing. And instead just wants to find her own independence and happiness and just maintain that for as long as she can. But then she, of course, accidentally finds herself becoming enamored. And that is her ado, I suppose. It gets especially ado-y when a death occurs. Perhaps it's suicide. Don't want to spoil it all for you. but there's this, it's one of these Shakespeare scenes that crops up in, monologue books for auditions. And it's just, it's one of those ones that the moment it starts, it's like, oh, I've heard this somewhere before. and it's the I would eat his heart in the marketplace. And it just, Elizabeth's performance of this scene truly just blew me away. As I said to her on the grass later, it was just like, if I'd gone in having no idea who she was, I would have left just so impressed by what she pulled off in just that scene alone. It certainly stood out as just again, if I had to rank this thing in the top three of it, it would have been this scene. Just the desperation and the thirst for revenge and just the seething of the entire thing. I just thought it was captivating. She's such an impressive performer. She's so magnificent. And I'm always counting down the days between opportunities to see her on stage because it's truly where she belongs. And we're all lucky that she's up there. But I covered as much of the ado and of the nothing as I could. And that's that. If you've got any questions about the plot, don't send them to me because I can already feel it seeping out of my ears. Potentially just for my mind wanting me to get to experience the twists and turns as if for the first time next time I indulge in this text. Thank you so, so much for being here with me, sweet, sweet listener. Thank you for being so generous with your time. I'm not going to keep you much longer. The next episode that happens is going to be the beginning of our second annual, Jake and Jamesy's Chuckle Fest, where we're going to see as much of the comedy festival as we can and let you know what it's like. Hopefully while you too are having your own parallel experience of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. That's it from me for right now. Thank you again. As usual, I may already disagree with everything I just said. And friends, don't let friends become theatre critics. Speak to you super duper soon, and I hope you're having a wonderful day.